spend half an hour watching the news, and it's easy to find yourself convinced that the world is in big trouble. The coverage of suicide bombings, murder, civil war, and general sadism is about enough to convince most of us that the world these days is a dangerous place filled with violence and untimely death. Well, for once, there seems to be good news, according to our guest this hour. He says the world is actually a safer place now than it used to be. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Steven Pinker. He's a Harvard College professor of psychology at Harvard University and the author of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. And we want to know what you think. Is it hard for you to believe that we're less violent now than we used to be? And if so, why don't we feel that way? Why doesn't the world feel safer? And why are pockets of America still so much more violent than, say, England? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And you can also join in on our Facebook page. It's The Veronica Rickert Show. And Steven Pinker, so glad you could be with us today.
Thank you.
Well, you know, it might be partially the economic times we're living through, but in general, I think most people, if you ask them out of the blue, you know, is the world a safer place now or is it more dangerous? They'd say it's more dangerous. It's more violent. And then along comes your book, Better Angels, and the news that apparently we're wrong about this. What's going on with the disconnect here?
Well, people estimate how risky the world is by how easily they can remember examples. And there's no shortage of violent examples, and they're covered in gory detail by the news. Things blow up. People go postal. There are nasty little civil wars in various parts of the world, and they're all going to be covered by the news. But what the news doesn't cover is all of the people who are dying peacefully in their sleep in parts of the world like Lithuania and Tanzania and Bolivia and so on. You don't send a camera crew to some guy who's dying of Alzheimer's disease. And so without knowing how many people are not dying violently, you can get a skewed impression of how common violence is. And the scholars who actually try to measure violence as a proportion of the population and compare it over time have shown that, in fact, we're living in unusually peaceful times.
It's interesting because it seems, you know, there are so many visceral images of violence that we tend to see, you know, on the internet, on the TV news. But yet if you look at a time which by the statistical standards is truly violent, say the Middle Ages, it pales in comparison, I guess.
That's right. Violence certainly has not gone down to zero. And wherever it does occur, we're going to hear about it. So there's never going to be a day in the planet when there's not enough violence to fill the news. And so if that's what you go by, and that is the way the human mind works, we go by vivid examples rather than by statistics. But it's the statistics that give you the real picture.
Well, in terms of what real violence looks like, can you give us a sense of what life was like in those more violent eras?
Well, take tribal warfare, the state in which our species spent most of its existence before there were settled states and governments. They certainly weren't violent all the time, but there would often be a tribal raid every couple of years in which a raiding party would surround a town before dawn and shoot people with arrows as they left their huts first thing in the morning, and they could rack up death tolls that would be sometimes 10, 15, 25, 60% of the population dying from violence. And even during the worst years of the 20th century, during the world wars, the death rates were never that high. Then in the Middle Ages, where homicide records go back several hundred years, we see rates that were about 35 times higher than the rates in Europe today. The impulsive violence would commonly break out. There'd be an argument over the dinner table, and everyone had a dagger, which they used to carve up the roast in front of them. And before you know it, the dagger would cut off a nose or go through someone's gut. And then there were the knights, who we tend to romanticize today. We think of King Arthur and Camelot, but they were basically warlords who were constantly attacking each other by killing as many of the other knights' peasants as possible to reduce his economic capacity. So both accounts of day-to-day life and the statistics of how many people died at the hands of other people show that that the past was a very unpleasant place.
Well, so then how do we get from chopping off one another's noses over the dinner table to showing some kind of restraint and reason when it comes to our violent impulses?
Partly it was the spread of government and a nationalized system of justice. So if you don't have to protect yourself by developing a reputation for toughness and a willingness to retaliate against any insult or sign of weakness, if you can outsource your bodyguard status to duties to the state, well, then you've got a third party who's adjudicating disputes, a party that isn't as intoxicated by self-serving biases. Everyone thinks they're right and that their enemy is just evil and deserving of severe punishment. If it's a third party doing it, the police and judges, on average, you're better off. You have fewer cycles of revenge and feuding and vendetta. So the spread of government leads then to a social change and cultural change when you can start to relax. You don't always have to be on a hair trigger to retaliate against any insult. More of a premium gets put on men being dignified and restrained and in control of their passions, as opposed to being ready to reach for the knife as soon as someone disses them. Another factor is just the spread of commerce and trade and exchange. If the way you get rich is not by plunder, by conquering the neighbor's territory and killing his peasants, but rather making something that he wants to buy and vice versa, that has a kind of pacifying effect. Other people become more valuable alive than dead. It becomes cheaper to buy stuff than to steal it. And that also trickles down into the culture, where the ability to think about what your customer wants, to woo customers away from your competitors, puts a premium on self-restraint and politeness and away from macho dominance and fierceness.
You know, it's interesting. You're painting a picture of really the evolution of civilization as we get more sophisticated with our government, the stability of the state, the way that trade functions. It almost sounds like it's more the sort of cultural societal symbiosis about you scratch my back, I scratch yours, or at least I don't stab yours, instead of kind of what I was hoping for, which was that as human beings, we become more moral creatures. Our moral evolution has evolved. Do you think they're one and the same, or is there a difference?
I think they can feed off each other, but I think they are different. The you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, which is what evolutionary psychologists call reciprocal altruism, is one of the mechanisms by which this competitive process of Darwinian natural selection can nonetheless result in cooperation and fairness and even affection and love and warmth. I think also, not to downplay the role of empathy and morality, I think they've also played a role, but it helps when you can afford the luxury of living by morality when you don't have to worry that you're going to be knifed in the back. I think the ratcheting down of an ethic of tribal loyalty, honor, revenge, it might even be a prerequisite to thinking about a more rational and moral way of living your lives.
What about something like placing a higher premium on kind of the sacredness of human life? That seems to have been a different ethos that we've moved into.
It is, and you see it in other spheres of life, like the fact that we spend more money to make our cars safer, our workplaces safer, our houses safer. We worry more about the safety of our children than our ancestors did. So there is a general valuation of life that seems to have increased. And it's hard to know whether the various campaigns to reduce violence are a cause or an effect of a general increase in the valuation of life, whether now that we don't have to worry about being knifed and stabbed and shot, we can make our lives better in other ways, or whether an increased value on life means that you target violence as something to be eliminated.
Hmm. Were you surprised by what you found, or did you expect to find this?
I was surprised. When I set out to write the book, I knew there was a lot of violence in the past, and I knew that some of it had come down. I was shocked at the amount of sadism and barbarism in the past, how gruesome the tortures were in the Middle Ages and how common, how much sadistic atrocities, ripping people apart with knives and clubbing them during genocides and ethnic riots, and how common those were until really recently, that a lot of the genocides of the last 100 years involved a lot of hands-on violence, where people were tortured and torn to bits by angry mobs. But then I was also surprised at how many categories of violence had shown declines in the last 50 or 60 years. I knew that rates of murder were a fraction of what they were during the Middle Ages, but I didn't realize that in the last 40 years or so, rates of rape have come down, rates of child abuse, rates of spousal abuse, the number of vegetarians have gone up. There seems to be a lot of forces pushing in the direction of less violence more recently, and I was surprised to see that reflected in so many graphs and data sets.
Are there exceptions to this?
Yes, there. It's not a smooth decline, and it would be rather uncanny and mysterious if somehow this peaceful cloud had just descended over the whole planet, making everyone more peaceful at once. So it's a very bumpy, uneven process with a lot of local reversals. One example would be the rise of genocidal dictators in the middle decades of the 20th century, Hitler, Stalin, and Mao in particular. Another would be the more than doubling of the violent crime rate in the United States and other Western countries in the 1960s. A third would be outbreaks of civil war in newly independent countries in the developing world starting in the 1960s. In each one of these cases, the violence was not historically unprecedented. And interestingly, in each of these cases, those increases were subsequently reversed and did not become a permanent scourge of humanity, but were ugly reversals, but which then the reversals were reversed.
Well, and I guess there are still pockets of America, including, I guess, the South, where it's still not true, where it's still a more dangerous place to be alive.
Yes, there's a lot of unevenness across the globe, and there's a lot of unevenness within the United States.
Where are the most dangerous places in the U.S.?
Louisiana and District of Columbia have the highest murder rates in the country. The two main divides within the United States are the North-South divide, where the northern states are less violent than the southern states, southern and southwestern states. And then there's also a black-white divide. There are higher rates of violence among African-Americans than among European-Americans. Of them, by the way, the North-South gap has been with us always since colonial times. As far back as records go, Southerners killed each other more than Northerners. The black-white gap, though, has not always been with us. 150 years ago, the murder rate for blacks and whites was identical, and then they started to diverge, which is what we see today.
If you wanted to live in the safest place in America, where would you live?
Probably northern states like Maine, Vermont, Washington, I believe, Oregon. Utah is among the western states. It's the only one with a low homicide rate.
Hmm.
I can look up the figures for Wisconsin. I have a color-coded map in the book of the murder rates of the 50 American states. So if people who want to get a copy of my book can look it up and see what color Wisconsin is.
How has this made you feel about your fellow human beings? Do you feel like you're maybe invested with a sense of optimism about humanity?
Strongly mixed. And the epigraph for the book is a quote from Pascal, that what are we to make of this chimera called man, the glory and the scum of the universe? You see in humans capacity for absolutely sickening sadism, cruelty, violence, callousness. You also see in humans compassion, empathy, reason, fairness, and the course of history very much depends on which of those sides of human nature is brought out. And I call the book The Better Angels of Our Nature, taking the quote from Abraham Lincoln, because it captures the idea that human nature is complex, that there are, we have the allusion to better angels implies that that's a part of human nature we can appeal to, although not the only part, because there's some rather ugly bits in there too.
Do you think that our brains might be evolving to, you know, maybe sometime in the distant future, the parts of our brain that tend to be associated with violence will be just sort of these vestigial dead zones?
It's certainly possible, and I discuss that possibility in the book, whether even over the course of the last few centuries there could have been literally Darwinian natural selection for more peaceable inclinations, less impulsive violence, less of an urge for dominance, becoming the alpha male. I don't think we have good evidence as to whether that has taken place, and I end up not embracing that theory, simply because some of these changes have been so recent, over a span of decades, that they exceed the speed limit of evolution, which is measured in generations. Could it happen in the future? It's not impossible. It would have to be worldwide, or in parts of the world that are not only consistently peaceful but don't have too much mixing of populations for more violent parts. It would have to occur over many generations. And it would have to be the case that the more violent people were penalized in terms of how many surviving offspring they have. That could have happened in the past. It could happen in the future, but we don't really know for sure.
Well, we're talking this hour with our guest, Steven Pinker. He is a Harvard College professor of psychology at Harvard University and the author of the new book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. And we're interested to know what you think this morning. Does it seem to you that the world is a less violent place? And what do you make of this news? Why don't we tend to feel that the world is a safer place? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can send your email to talk@WPR.org or chime in on Facebook at The Veronica Rickert Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this Friday morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, as we talk with Steven Pinker, who is a Harvard College professor of psychology at Harvard University. And we're talking about his new book this morning. It is called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. And we'll go to our first phone call now. We've got Andy joining us from Lake Geneva. Hi, Andy.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I think I might have missed it when I was calling in, but I think, you know, on an individual basis, as the professor points out, I think violence has effectively subsided because of government, because obviously of government and of organized police forces and the like, and a general civilized nature. But institutional violence, which we have seen, we've seen dramatically in the past, witness World War II, Nazi Germany, and now, the constant wars really invokes, and I think I would answer your question where you said it just sort of seems, when I look around, things seem a little bit violent. I don't think you can leave spirituality out of this, and one of God and good and evil, separate from evolution and so on. And for your listeners, there's a telling phrase in the Bible, in the New Testament, Matthew 24, where we're right in what's called the Age of Sorrows now, where there's earthquakes, famines, pestilence, wars, and rumors of wars. those four things. And if you look around today, in many ways, that's what we're in. And there's sort of a sorrow that begins to envelop, which I think you expressed earlier. It's not on an individual level. It's in these four areas of earthquakes, geological activity, which is dramatic, famines, pestilences, like AIDS, and stuff mm-hmm. like that, and then wars and rumors of war.
Let's get our guest in. Steven Pinker, what do you think?
Yeah, all of those are less common today than they were in the past. So we're actually not living in an era of increased pestilence, famine, and war. Earthquakes, I don't think, have decreased, but there's no reason to think that they've increased. Earthquakes have shaped the surface of the Earth, and a lot of the every time you look at a mountain, you're seeing an effect of earthquakes in the past. Institutional violence is down in the first decade of the 21st century has some of the lowest rates of death in warfare as a proportion of the world's population since statistics have been kept. And life expectancy has been increasing. Deaths from both infectious disease and from hunger and starvation are actually lower worldwide in this decade than they have been in previous decades. So, in fact, the kind of biblical prediction that we're in particular times of troubles that are presaging some apocalypse or Armageddon or Revelation, forget it. The data are go against that.
And it sounded like Andy was maybe sort of suggesting that there's a correlation between the faithful of any religion and violence. Is there?
There's I talk in the book about the role of religion, and most of it is not a pretty picture, that some of the worst atrocities in history have been committed out of religious reasons. The Crusades, which resulted in many genocides and a death toll that was equivalent to the Nazi Holocaust. The European Wars of Religion, which led to death tolls that proportionally were worse than World War I and almost as bad as World War II in Europe. The Inquisition, the Taiping Rebellion in China, which was the worst civil war in history, which was religiously inspired. Now, it isn't that religions have caused all the atrocities in history, by no means, but they're responsible for a lot of them. Religions have sometimes had a pacifying role in the settling of and pacification of the American West. The churches helped the wild young men settle down in families and a respectable lifestyle. Some of the reconciliation movements in the developing world have been led by religious leaders like Desmond Tutu. But on the whole, I don't think one could say that religion has in general been a force for peace, to put it mildly.
Well, on the flip side, is there a link at all between the rise in secularism and violence, or lack of violence?
No, because the long-term historical trend is for there to be less violence, and the long-term historical trend is for secularism to have increased. It's actually not secularism versus religion per se, I think, that's been a significant historical force, but rather a kind of humanism growing out of the Enlightenment that places a value on the lives of individual men, women, and children. The belief systems that have denied that have elevated the race or the class or the nation or the faithful as the ultimate value and considers individual people just like cells in a body or constituents of a whole, and it's the group that has to be valorized. I think that's led to enormous amounts of violence, and it's, on the contrary, the kind of humanistic, secular, liberal way of thinking that says, really written into our Constitution, that there's individuals have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and institutions like nations and governments are just there to help them do it, rather than that people are cells in a body that can be easily sacrificed for the benefit of the whole. I consider that to be the fundamental divide, and the increase in human-centered value systems that has helped drive violence down, such as the doctrine of human rights.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the phones now. Gil joining us next from Madison. Hi, Gil.
Hi. I had a question about the statistical trend that the author is looking at. I mean, is this a is this a linear trend or a cyclical trend? You know, lots of the sort of older organized religions see things in cycles, and that maybe things are good right now, and but they're going to get worse later, and it was just kind of a cyclical trend. And then one other question about how this whole climate change fits into things and the availability of resources affecting how much violence takes place in terms of energy and food and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, both very good questions. There doesn't seem to be any evidence for cycles in history. There is, that is, it's not that if you have a period of peace, it just means that tensions are building up and the whole system is going to blow any minute. There is, though, but it, nor is it linear. There is a lot of randomness in the distribution of wars over time. There's a lot of unpredictability. So it certainly is possible that another war could happen, even another big war. I think the chances are less, but the chances are not zero, so it can happen. The gods of war do play dice. In terms of the effects of climate change, it's I think there's no doubt that climate change is going to make bring a lot of misery, and it's definitely going to be a it's not good news. Whether the misery will be in the form of war is not as certain, because there is a pretty loose correlation between resource conflict and war. Lots of wars were not fought over finite vital resources, and often there can be shortages of resources that don't lead to war. And statistical studies that try to see whether drought or famine predicts the an onset of a civil war find that there's not much of a connection. There can be a lot of misery. There can be local skirmishes over watering holes or lands. But to have a real war, you've got to have a political leader decide to mobilize an army to do it. And lots of times local leaders don't particularly care that their populations are starving or not. And when they do go to war, it's often out of rectifying old injustices or territorial ambitions or all kinds of screwball reasons that don't actually have to do with fighting over resources. So I would not say it's impossible, and I certainly wouldn't say that climate change is something to be taken lightly, but it's not guaranteed that it will lead to war.
Well, thank you for that call, Gil. And barring a climate change scenario like you're talking about, the era we're in right now is something you write about as the long peace. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, it's a term from the historian John Gaddis, and it refers to the fact that since World War II, a number of historically unusual things have happened, or maybe I should say haven't happened, namely great powers going to war with each other. At any given time in history, the half dozen or so most powerful countries on Earth, called the great powers, it used to be that getting into wars was what they did. They did it more often than not. They were at each other's throats. It may have been in one era, Britain versus France, or Germany versus Russia. And all of a sudden that stopped after World War II, including the most consequential great power rivalry of all, the U.S. versus the Soviet Union, where, contrary to all predictions that World War III was inevitable, they stayed out of each other's face in terms of direct military confrontations. And at the same time, developed countries stopped going to war. We take it for granted now that war is something that happens in the poorer, nastier parts of the world. But it wasn't always like that. It used to be that it was the Netherlands and Britain and Spain and Italy and Sweden and all of the richest countries in the world that were constantly making trouble. Now they stay out of each other's way. These phenomena, historically unusual, are what I've been calling the long peace.
And this is what, the last 20 years?
No, this would be the last 66 years.
Oh, 66 years.
Or maybe the last 50 years, depending on how you count.
Well,
yeah.
I was just going to say, it's interesting that 66, I mean, it's more than 20, but 66 isn't that long. I mean, I guess we're kind of new at this peace thing.
We are kind of new at this peace thing, although it's longer than any previous period of great power peace. When people talk about the peaceful 19th century. They are talking about two interludes that were, I think, 47 and 33 years. So 66 is, we've broken a lot of records in those 66 years. You mentioned the last 20 years, and there's been another subsequent change in the last 20 years, and that is that the long piece is starting to spread to the rest of the world. And you can only go back 20 years to make this claim. But rates of death in warfare have fallen since the end of the Cold War in the late 80s, early 90s. And both the number of conflicts and the number of deaths have gone down to the point where in this decade we're breaking a number of records for how low a percentage of the population dies in warfare.
Wow. That does sound like something.
That is very recent, and who knows how long it'll last, but let's certainly enjoy it. Let's figure out what
we're doing right.
What we're doing right.
All right, let's go to one more call before break. We've got John joining us from Madison. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing? I'm not really from Madison. I'm from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I'm just driving through.
Oh, okay. Right, well, thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask the doctor about, you know, I'm in the Army, and I've been stationed in Afghanistan and Iraq. I've been to Saudi Arabia. I also was stationed down at Fort Bliss, Texas, for a while back in the 90s, along the border with Juarez, and we used to go back and forth across the border all the time. Today, like, you can't even go to Mexico if you're in the military. They won't let you cross the border, and it's a real dangerous place, you know. And that's a westernized government set up in place, and it's more dangerous in Mexico than it is Afghanistan.
Hmm.
You know, you see a fall of our Western governments as a potential to lead to escalating violence around the world.
Yes, well, you've been in three of the most violent places on Earth, and so you've gotten a very concentrated dose of the worst that we're still capable of. In Mexico, it's in some ways typical of some of the remaining dangerous parts of the world in that there are zones of anarchy that are carved out when you have economies based on contraband, in this case drugs, because if you're dealing in an illegal substance, you can't call in the police to resolve your disputes. You can't press a lawsuit. And the only way to defend your interest is being retaliating violently and being tough enough to deter violence. And just as with mafia rum runners in the 1930s, in tribal herders beyond the reach of the law in mountainous regions, when you have these zones where the police and government can't reach, violence can go through the roof. All the more so in areas where, in fact, the powerful drug lords make sure that the police can't come in by murdering them and any judges that go against them. So these are the places on Earth that tend to have high rates of violence, and it sounds like you're intimately familiar with them.
Do you think that we'll ever get to a point where we see a world without violence? I mean, maybe the occasional personal violent act, but do you think in terms of these mass conflicts and mass deaths, we'll be able to get to that point, or is it just not within the scope of human nature?
Well, I think it's in terms of organized, socially sanctioned violence, where it's not just one guy having an outburst, but he's got to get a lot of people to and a lot of institutions to go along with them. There, it's not unreasonable to think that it could go way down. Whether it could go to zero, I don't know. But we do know that parts of the world can remain in peace indefinitely. I don't think any of us is losing sleep over an invasion across the border with Canada, and the Canadians aren't losing sleep either. Could that happen on larger and larger parts of the world? Well, it already is happening. How far it can go, we don't know, but I think it can go a lot farther.
We're talking this hour with Steven Pinker. He's got a new book out, and it's called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. Steven Pinker is a Harvard College professor of psychology at Harvard University. And we're curious to know what you're thinking about a less violent world. How does it seem to you? What do you think is the secret to how we got here and maybe how we can move further in that direction? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, keeping you company this Friday morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our pledge drive starts on Tuesday, and we shortened it from the usual 12 days to just 6. That's 6 days. But shorter pledge drives only work when we raise some of the money that we need beforehand. And for that, we need your help. So go to WPR.org and make your donation now. And thank you. Our guest this hour is Steven Pinker. He's a Harvard College professor of psychology at Harvard University and the author of the new book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. And we go back to our phone lines now. We've got Mike with us next from Milwaukee. Hello, Mike.
Hi. I was just curious as far as how the Great Recession today compares with the Great Depression as far as violence. And I know there are probably different reporting statistics back then. I'm sure rapes weren't as reported as they are today and such. But how do the two economic situations compare? In other words, my question is basically, we have this the Walton's image of what the Depression was like, and from what I understand, it was quite violent back then.
Interesting question. Thanks, Mike.
Yes. To everyone's surprise, the Great Recession of 2008 resulted in a decline of violent crime. Everyone would have predicted that violent crime would go up, but it's gone down 3 years in a row. During the Great Depression, it depends on which years you talk about, there was a general increase in violence through the 20s into the early 30s. And then in 1933, there was a sudden plunge in violence. So if the Depression started in, let's say, 29, the first years continued the trend of violence, and then the floor dropped out. The most likely cause was the repeal of Prohibition. That, as with what's happening in Juarez right now, where the drug lords are killing each other with abandon because they live in a zone of anarchy, the mafia drug runners, the Chicago gangsters, and their equivalents in other cities caused huge rates of violence. And then when when Prohibition came, it seemed to usher in an era of relative domestic peace as the whole trade got legalized and there was less to fight about and more of the rum runners were put behind bars. There may be other reasons why the recession led to less violence, but that's the Depression, at least a few years in. But that was one of them. It's possible there were more nebulous things, that just as optimism increased and people had greater faith in government after the election of Roosevelt, that where there's greater degrees of social trust, there's some reason to think that violence goes down, although that could not account for why violence has gone down in the last 3 years, where trust in government institutions has been falling. So that is, and that's one way to say, to confess, that there's a lot about rates of violence that none of the experts can really, really understand.
We're still cracking that nut.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that call, Mike. I've heard in terms of trust in government that Scandinavia is one area of the world where people have an incredibly high trust in society and government. Does that correlate with a low violence rate there, lower than normal, maybe?
It does. And the Scandinavian countries are the safest places on Earth, despite the recent Norwegian shooter. The homicide rates in Western and Northern Europe are pretty much as low as you can go. And there's some reason to think that the historian Randolph Roth, who's looked at homicide rates in the United States since colonial times, believes that in periods where people trust the social order and the government, violent crime goes down. In periods where everyone thinks that it's every man for himself, it goes back up. And it makes some sense, because even when you have an effective government and police force, it's not as if you've got snipers on every roof and security cameras watching you 24/7 to haul you off to jail if you have a fist fight. It's got to be that when, even when Big Brother's back is turned, you have to feel that the rules are there and they're being applied fairly and they're being applied to your enemies as well as to you in order to inhibit you from violence. And that may be the basis of this correlation.
What about a comparison between countries with capitalism and countries with socialism, where there's sort of a more collective mentality, or communism?
I think it probably depends on the kind of socialism. If it's the kind of wimpy socialism of Scandinavia, that might help in giving enough trust in institutions that people are less likely to engage in violence. When it comes to communist regimes forced from the top down, if it's a real police state, and if you really do have police officers stationed on every block watching your every move, then that does tend to reduce violence. Though the police force people to love each other very much, as one citizen put it. In the kind of Marxist governments that are also inept and don't brutalize their populations, there you can have very high rates of violence, where you have neither the social trust of a civilized democracy nor the reign of terror of a police state.
Let's go back to our phones now. Amanda is joining us from Janesville. Hi, Amanda.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was just wondering, I actually work for an organization called 1,000 Sisters, and we are working to end the violence in places like the Congo. I'm sorry, I'm walking to school, so I'm a little out of breath.
It's okay.
And Somalia and things like that. And I know the recent statistics have come out that 4 women every 5 minutes are being raped in the Congo. I just kind of wanted to know what he thinks of that area.
Yes, well, the Democratic Republic of Congo has seen some of the most horrific violence of recent periods, continuing to the present. Their peak was between 1998 and 2003. Some of the statistics that have come out are actually too high. They come from very sketchy statistical extrapolations from surveys. And so the statistic, for example, that 5.4 million people were killed in the DRC is almost certainly too high. This is not to say that it isn't way too high and that it's quite laudable that you're putting efforts into bringing it down.
Well, thank you for your call, Amanda. And we'll move next to Nathan joining us from Madison. Hi, Nathan.
Yeah, hi. You mentioned earlier about the decreasing rates of violence since World War II, and I'm curious as to how you view nuclear weapons as working into that in terms of working both as a deterrence during the Cold War and then currently the idea of nuclear deterrence.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Great. Thanks, Nathan.
Yeah, it's a good question. So one political scientist proposed that the nuclear bomb be given the Nobel Peace Prize for having basically scared the world away from war. And this is sometimes called the nuclear peace theory. I'm actually skeptical of it, following arguments by John Mueller and others who noted a number of curious facts. One of them is that the nuclear bomb has really not been much of a deterrent, other than for all-out Dr. Strangelove-style annihilation. But in many cases, countries without nuclear weapons have actually declared war on countries with nuclear weapons. The Argentinians, for example, took over the Falkland Islands, confident that Britain's nuclear capability was a bluff, that England would not leave Buenos Aires a radioactive crater in retaliation. Sadat of Egypt invaded Israel-controlled Sinai in 1973, even though Israel had nuclear weapons and Egypt did not. Even the Soviet Union taking over Eastern Europe in the late 1940s, it did so at a time when the United States had a nuclear monopoly. What happened was, first of all, that the nuclear bomb got such a stigma of apocalyptic horror that a taboo arose around its use in conventional warfare. And so, in effect, it became kind of a bluff and had very little effect. In terms of the two superpowers, they were so deterred by the prospect of conventional war. World War II was so massively destructive, especially to the Soviet Union, just with good old-fashioned tanks and artillery and bombers and sieges, that no one wanted a repeat. And so nuclear weapons or no nuclear weapons, the U.S. and the USSR weren't looking forward to a rematch anytime soon. And so even though they rattled their sabers at each other, they stoked proxy wars in the Third World, they stayed away from each other when it came to direct battlefield confrontation, and probably would have done so even if they were not armed with nukes.
Well, obviously, the threat of weapons of mass destruction is still something that scares the socks off of us. It got us involved in a war, for starters. I mean, do you really feel that that is something that is just true now, that this is sort of...
Yeah, it's I go into the dread of nuclear terrorism, and again, relying on people who study this in quite a bit of detail, no one could say that the probability is zero, and no one should say that we should relax about it and not implement very strong measures to prevent it from happening. But I don't think it's particularly likely that the era of loosely guarded nuclear facilities following the collapse of the Soviet Union is over, and it's safe to say that the Russians are very concerned that their weapons not fall into the hand of, say, Chechen terrorists. The possibility of filching nuclear material and making a nuke in your garage is probably harder than people think it is. So I don't think we should be complacent about it, but nor do I think that that it's going to happen.
I think we have time for one or two more callers. Let's go next to Jeff with us from Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could anticipate what the future looks like. I remember someone once saying that the decline in violence was directly related to sofas and television, but you need jobs for those. So I'm wondering what you see in the future, and I will listen off air. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. Well, as Yogi Berra put it, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. And I am very cautious in Better Angels, because there can be nasty surprises. There can be unknown unknowns. Some fanatic could take over a state and plunge it back into war. I would not say that that cannot happen. I do think, though, that some of the trends are going to continue. I think that that violence against women will decrease because it has been so prioritized by the world. And in the past, when there have been moral shaming and activist campaigns, such as against slavery and whaling and piracy, they have been effective. I think that that probably wars between developed countries won't make a comeback anytime soon. I think capital punishment will probably dwindle even in the United States and certainly in the rest of the world. I think probably democracies will become more common in 30 years than they are today. But whether some bellicose nationalistic leader might take over China and decide, well, once and for all, it's time to get Taiwan back and plunge the world back into war, or Russia will have some jingoistic leader who thinks that it's a good idea to conquer a former republic or two, who knows whether that can happen or not. So in some regards, I'm willing to extrapolate these optimistic trends. In other cases, I'd be much more cautious.
Well, if you had to extract some advice from all of this research that you've done, and I mean, you had to sit down with a panel of world leaders and tell them, here's a few things that you can do to decrease violence in your country and in the world, what would you tell them?
Certainly a decent police force and judiciary system would be a good place to start. That is a competent government, one that doesn't brutalize its citizens, but that doesn't let local violence get out of hand, that doesn't let its judges and police force become too corrupt or too intimidated. I think institutions of education where young people have alternatives to joining warlord gangs, and people are given the confidence that their government can do some things right and therefore sympathize with the government as opposed to insurgent forces. So institutions, good old-fashioned boring institutions like schools and health clinics and courts are a good place to start. I think open economies where there's an infrastructure of commerce so you can earn an honest living by buying and selling things makes people more peaceful. And I think a general realization that that violence statistically actually doesn't work very well. Violent insurgent movements are less successful than nonviolent ones. Terrorist movements almost always fail. Contrary to the old idea that you cannot achieve justice without a little bit of violence, that people in power never give up power voluntarily, they have to be forced out by violence, turns out to be historically inaccurate.
Hmm.
If that idea got out, there'd be less of a temptation to try to hasten along justice at the point of a machine gun.
Well, Steven Pinker, thank you for all the good news this hour. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Steven Pinker, our guest this hour, a Harvard College professor of psychology at Harvard University and the author of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this one and for her technical direction this morning. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for answering your phone calls. And thanks to you for listening and for calling up. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.